for the first time, a quantitative language for chemistry, a new way to understand the experiments chemists carried out in terms of the exchange of atoms among molecules. In the modern version, for example, to describe the creation of water from oxygen and hydrogen, a chemist or high school student would write 2H2 plus O2 goes to 2H2O. The new language of chemistry revolutionized chemists' ability to understand and reason about what they were observing and measuring when they created chemical reactions, and his ideas have been central to the theory of chemistry ever since. Dalton's work made him world famous, and though he shunned public honors, he received them, including a membership in the Royal Society that was bestowed over his vehement objections. When he died in 1844, the funeral that he had hoped would be modest drew more than 40,000 mourners. Through Dalton's efforts, human thinking regarding the nature of substance had progressed from the theories proposed by the ancient mystical lore to the beginnings of an understanding of matter on a level far beyond the reach of our senses. But if each element is distinguished by the weight of its atoms, how is that atomic property related to the chemical and physical characteristics we observe? That is the next leg of the relay, and indeed, the last of the profound questions about chemistry that could be answered without moving beyond Newtonian science. Deeper insights would come, but they would have to await the quantum revolution in physics. Stephen Hawking, having survived for decades despite being paralyzed with an illness that was supposed to kill him in just a few years, once told me that he considered stubbornness to be his greatest trait, and I believe he may be right. Though it makes him at times difficult to work with, he knew that it's his stubbornness that both keeps him alive and gives him the strength to continue to do his research. The finished theories of science may seem almost self-evident once they have been formulated, but the struggle to create them can usually be won only through magnificent perseverance. Psychologists speak of a quality called grit, an attribute related to perseverance and stubbornness, but also to passion, all characteristics we've seen much of in these pages. Defined as the disposition to pursue long-term goals with sustained interest and effort over time, they, not surprisingly, have found grit related to success in everything from marriage to the Army's Special Operations Forces. Perhaps that's why so many of the characters we've met so far in our story were headstrong, even arrogant. Most innovators are. They have to be. Our next pioneer, Dmitry Mendeleev, a Russian chemist known for his tantrums and fits of rage, and for having his hair and beard trimmed just once each year, fits comfortably in that pantheon of stubborn mules. So strong was his personality, in fact, that his wife eventually learned to avoid him by living at their country estate, except when he showed up there, at which time she'd grab the kids and move to their city residence. Mendeleev, like Hawking, was a survivor. In his late teens, he was hospitalized for tuberculosis, but he not only survived, he found a nearby laboratory and spent his days of recuperation performing chemistry experiments there. Later, after obtaining his teaching credential, he angered an official at the Ministry of Education and, as a result, was assigned to teach at a high school in faraway Crimea. The year was 1855, and when Mendeleev arrived, he found that not only was the high school in a war zone, but it had long ago been closed. Undeterred, he returned home, gave up on his prospects of a high school teaching career, and took a job as a privatdozent, one who lectures for tips, at the University of St. Petersburg. He eventually became a professor there. That Mendeleev was a chemist, or even educated at all, he owed entirely to his mother. He was born to a poor family in western Siberia, the youngest of either 14 or 17 children, accounts vary. He did poorly in school, but enjoyed performing makeshift science experiments. His mother believed in his intellect, and when he was 15, after his father died, she set off on the road with him, looking for a university that would take him. It proved to be a journey of 1,400 miles, involving much hitchhiking and horse-drawn wagons, but in the end, he got a small scholarship at the Central Pedagogical Institute in St. Petersburg, where the director was an old friend of his late father. His mother died soon afterward. 37 years later, he dedicated a scientific treatise to her memory, quoting what he called her sacred dying words. "Refrain from illusions, insist on work and not on words. Patiently seek divine and scientific truth." Mendeleev, like so many great scientists before him, would live his life by those words. In one sense, Mendeleev was lucky to have been born when he was. Virtually every great discovery and innovation has arisen from a combination of human insight and happy circumstance. Einstein was lucky to have begun his career shortly after the formulation of the modern theory of electromagnetism, which implied that the speed of light is constant, an idea that would become the essence of his theory of relativity. Steve Jobs was likewise lucky to have begun his career at a time when technology was just reaching the stage at which a useful personal computer could be developed. On the other hand, Armenian-American inventor and businessman Luther Simjian held many patents, but he had his best idea just a decade or so too early. He conceived of the automated teller machine, ATM, which he called the bankograph, in 1960. He persuaded a New York City bank to install a few, but people did not trust them to accept deposits, so the only ones who used them were prostitutes and gamblers who didn't want to deal with tellers face to face. A decade later, times had changed, and ATMs took off, but using someone else's design. Unlike Simjian, Mendeleev had the spirit of the times on his side. He reached adulthood at a moment when chemistry was ripe for advancement. The idea that the elements could be organized into families was in the air all over Europe in the 1860s. It hadn't gone unnoticed, for example, that fluorine, chlorine, and bromine, classified as halogens by Swedish chemist Jöns Jakob Berzelius in 1842, seemed to belong together. They are all extremely corrosive gases that become tamed when united with sodium, forming harmless salt-like crystals. Table salt, for example, is sodium chloride. Nor was it hard to detect the similarities among the alkali metals, like sodium, lithium, and potassium. These are all shiny, soft, and highly reactive. In fact, the members of the alkali metal family are so alike that if you swap potassium for sodium in table salt, what you get is close enough to sodium chloride that it is used as a salt substitute. Chemists inspired by Carl Linnaeus' scheme for classifying biological organisms sought to develop a comprehensive family system of their own to explain the relationships among the elements. But not all the groupings were obvious, nor was it known how they related to one another or what property of atoms was responsible for the family resemblances. Those issues attracted thinkers all over Europe. Even a sugar refiner got into the act, or at least the house chemist at a sugar refinery. But though a handful of thinkers knocked on the door of the answer, just one man, Mendeleev, crashed right through it. You'd think that if the idea of organizing the elements was in the air, then the person who succeeded at it would get a hearty cheer, but you wouldn't necessarily conclude that that person would be considered one of the greatest geniuses ever to work in his field, which Mendeleev is. What puts him in the class with titans like Boyle, Dalton, and Lavoisier? The periodic table that Mendeleev developed isn't the chemist's version of a field guide to the birds. Rather, it is chemistry's version of Newton's laws, or at least it's as close to that magical achievement as chemistry can hope to come. For it is not simply a table listing families of elements, it is a veritable Ouija board allowing chemists to understand and predict the properties of any elements, even those yet unknown. Looking back, it is easy to credit Mendeleev's breakthrough to his asking the right question at the right time, and to his work ethic, passion, stubbornness, and extreme self-confidence. but as has often been the case in discovery and innovation, and in many of our lives, just as important as his intellectual qualities was the role of chance, or at least an unrelated circumstance that set the stage for those qualities to achieve their triumph. In this case, it was Mendeleev's chance decision to write a chemistry textbook. The decision to write the text came in 1866, after Mendeleev received his appointment as professor of chemistry in St. Petersburg at age 32. St. Petersburg had been created a century and a half earlier by Peter the Great and was finally emerging as an intellectual center of Europe. Its university was the best in Russia, but Russia was behind the rest of Europe, and scanning Russia's chemistry literature, Mendeleev found no decent and up-to-date book to use in his teaching, hence his decision to write his own. The text would take years to complete and was destined to be translated into all the major languages and used in universities far and wide for decades to come. It was unorthodox, laden with anecdotes, speculation, and eccentricity. It was a work of love, and his drive to make it the best book possible was what forced him to focus on the issues that would lead him to his great discovery. The first challenge Mendeleev faced in writing his book was how to organize it. He decided to treat the elements and their compounds in groups or families defined by their properties. After the relatively easy task of describing the halogens and alkali metals, he confronted the issue of which group to write about next. Should the order be arbitrary, or might there be some organizing principle that would dictate it? Mendeleev struggled with the problem, looking deep into his vast chemical knowledge for clues to how the different groups might be related. One Saturday, he became so focused that he worked through the entire night and into the morning. He got nowhere, but then something possessed him to write the names of the elements in the oxygen, nitrogen, and halogen groups, 12 elements in all, on the back of one of his envelopes, in ascending order according to their atomic weights. Now he suddenly noticed a striking pattern. The list began with nitrogen, oxygen, and fluorine, the lightest member of each group, and then continued with the second lightest member of each group, still in turn, and so on. The list, in other words, formed a repeating or periodic pattern. Only in the case of two of the elements did the pattern not hold. Mendeleev made his discovery more apparent by arranging the elements of each group into a row and writing the rows atop one another to make a table. Today we write the groups in columns. Was there really something to this? And if these 12 elements really did form a meaningful pattern, would the other 51 known at the time fit his scheme? Mendeleev and his friends used to play a card game called Patience, in which they laid out a deck and had to arrange the cards in a certain way. The cards formed a table that, he would later recount, looked much like the table of 12 elements he made that day. He decided to write the names and atomic weights of all the known elements on cards and try to make a table of that, playing what he now called chemical patience. He began moving the cards around, trying to arrange them in a way that made sense. There were serious problems with Mendeleev's approach. For one, it wasn't clear which group some elements ought to belong to. The properties of others were not well understood. There was also disagreement about the atomic weights of certain elements, and, as we now know, the weights assigned to some elements were just plain wrong. Perhaps most serious, there were elements yet to be discovered, and this had the effect of making his sequencing appear not to work. All these issues served to make Mendeleev's task difficult, but there was something else, something more subtle. There was no reason to believe that a scheme based on atomic weight should work, for no one at the time understood what chemical aspect of an atom its weight reflected. Here especially is where Mendeleev's stubbornness supported his passion to pursue his idea. He continued, based on intuition and faith alone. Mendeleev's work reveals, more literally than most, how the scientific process is an activity of puzzle solving. but it also illustrates important differences, because unlike the jigsaw puzzle you would buy in the store, the pieces in Mendeleev's puzzle did not fit. Part of science, and all innovation, is to sometimes ignore issues that seem to indicate that your approach cannot possibly work, in the belief that you will eventually find a workaround, or that the issues will prove irrelevant after all. In this case, through both remarkable brilliance and extraordinary persistence, Mendeleev created his picture by remaking some of the pieces of the puzzle and completely fabricating others. In hindsight, it is easy to characterize Mendeleev's accomplishment in a heroic light, as I suppose I have done. Even if your ideas sound crazy, if they work, we make you a hero. But there is a flip side, for there have been many crazy schemes throughout the ages that have proved wrong. Those schemes that work, in fact, are vastly outnumbered by those that don't. The wrong ones are quickly forgotten, the hours and days and years of work their believers put into them having ultimately been wasted. And often, we call the proponents of those schemes failures and crackpots. But heroism is about taking risks, and so what's really heroic about research, whether it pans out or doesn't, is that risk we scientists and other innovators take. Those long hours and days, months or even years, of intense intellectual struggle, which may or may not lead to a fruitful conclusion or product. Mendeleev certainly put in the time, and when an element didn't fall into place as he'd wanted, he refused to accept that his scheme was wrong. Instead, he stuck to his guns and concluded that those who had measured the atomic weight were wrong, and he boldly crossed out the measured weight and filled in the value that would make the element fit. His most audacious pronouncements came when his table left him with a gap somewhere, a spot in which no element existed that possessed the properties that were required. Rather than abandoning his ideas, or attempting to alter his organizing principle, he steadfastly insisted that those gaps represented undiscovered elements. He even predicted the new element's properties, their weight, their physical characteristics, which other elements they combine with, and the kinds of compounds they make, based solely on the spot in which the gap appeared. There was a gap next to aluminum, for example. Mendeleev filled it with an element he called ECA aluminum, and went on to predict that when some chemist eventually discovered ECA aluminum, it would be a shiny metal that conducted heat very well and had a low melting point, and that a cubic centimeter of the stuff would weigh precisely 5.9 grams. A few years later, a French chemist named Paul-Émile Lecoq-Dubois-Boudron discovered an element in ore samples that fit the bill, except that he found that it weighed 4.7 grams per cubic centimeter. Mendeleev immediately sent Lecoq a letter telling him that his sample must have been impure. Lecoq repeated his analysis with a new sample that he made sure to rigorously purify. This time, it weighed in at exactly what Mendeleev had predicted, 5.9 grams per cubic centimeter. Lecoq named it gallium, after the Latin name for France, Gallia. Mendeleev published his table in 1869, first in an obscure Russian journal, and then in a respected German publication, under the title On the Relationship of the Properties of the Elements to Their Atomic Weights. In addition to gallium, his table included placeholders for other yet unknown elements, today called scandium, germanium, and technetium. Technetium is radioactive and so rare it wasn't discovered until 1937 when it was synthesized in a cyclotron, a kind of particle accelerator, some 30 years after Mendeleev died. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry was first awarded in 1901, 6 years before Mendeleev's death. It is one of the great misjudgments of Nobel history that he never received the prize, for his table of elements was the central organizing principle of modern chemistry, the discovery that made possible our mastery of the science of substance, and the capstone to 2,000 years of work that had begun in the laboratories of embalmers and alchemists. But Mendeleev did eventually become a member of a more select club, In 1955, scientists at Berkeley produced just over a dozen atoms of a new element, again in a cyclotron, and in 1963, they designated it Mendelevium, in honor of his magnificent achievement. The Nobel Prize has been awarded to more than 800 individuals, but only 16 scientists have an element named for them. And Mendeleev is one of them, giving him his own spot on his table, where he appears as element 101, just a short distance from the likes of einsteinium and copernicium. Chapter 9. The Animate World. Though scholars since antiquity had speculated that material objects are made of fundamental building blocks, no one had guessed that so are living things. And so it must have come as quite a surprise when, in 1664, our old friend Robert Hooke sharpened his penknife until it was as keen as a razor, shaved a thin slice from a piece of cork, peered at it through his homemade microscope, and became the first human to see what he would call cells. He chose that name because they reminded him of the tiny bedrooms assigned to monks in their monasteries. One can think of cells as the atoms of life, but they are more complex than atoms, and, even more shocking to those who first perceive them, they are themselves alive. A cell is a vibrant living factory that consumes energy and raw materials and produces from them many diverse products, mainly proteins, which carry out almost every crucial biological function. It takes a lot of knowledge to perform the functions of a cell, so although cells don't have brains, they do know things. They know how to make the proteins and other materials we need to grow and function, and perhaps most crucial, they know how to reproduce. The most important single product of a cell is a copy of itself. As a result of that ability, we humans start from a single cell, and through a series of 40-plus cell doublings, we eventually come to be made of about 30 trillion cells, 100 times more cells than there are stars in the Milky Way. It is a great wonder that the sum of our cells' activities, the interaction of a galaxy of unthinking individuals, adds up to a whole that is us. Just as staggering a thought is the notion that we could untangle how all that works, like computers that, unbidden by any programmer, analyze themselves. That is the miracle of biology. The miracle appears even greater when you consider that most of the world of biology is invisible to us. That's partly due to the minuteness of cells, and partly due to the magnificent diversity of life. If you exclude creatures like bacteria, and count only living things with cells that have a nucleus, then, scientists estimate, there are roughly 10 million species on our planet, of which we have discovered and classified only about 1%. There are at least 22,000 species of ants alone, and somewhere between 1 and 10 million individual ants for every person on Earth. We are all familiar with a medley of backyard insects, but a scoop of good soil contains more types of creatures than we could ever count, hundreds or even thousands of invertebrate species, several thousand microscopic roundworms, and tens of thousands of types of bacteria. The presence of life on Earth is so pervasive, in fact, that we are continually ingesting organisms that we'd probably rather not eat. Try buying peanut butter that's free of insect fragments. You can't. The government recognizes that producing insect-free peanut butter is impractical, so regulations allow for up to 10 insect fragments per 31-gram serving. Meanwhile, a serving of broccoli may contain 60 aphids and/or mites, while a jar of ground cinnamon may contain 400 insect fragments. That all sounds unappetizing, but it's good to remember that even our own bodies are not free of foreign life. We are, each of us, an entire ecosystem of living things. Scientists have identified, for example, 44 genera, or species groups, of microscopic organisms that live on your forearm, and at least 160 species of bacteria that live in people's bowels. Between your toes, 40 species of fungi. In fact, if you bother to total it up, you find that there are far more microbial cells in our body than human cells. Our body parts each form a distinct habitat, and the creatures in your intestines, or between your toes, have more in common with the organisms in those regions of my body than with the creatures on your own forearm. There is even an academic center called the Belly Button Biodiversity Project at North Carolina State University, set up to study the life that exists in that dark, isolated landscape. And then there are the infamous skin mites. Relatives of ticks, spiders, and scorpions, these creatures are less than a third of a millimeter long and live on your face, in hair follicles and glands connected to hair follicles, mainly near the nose, eyelashes, and eyebrows, where they suck the innards out of your juicy cells. But don't worry, they normally cause no ill effects, and if you're an optimist, you can hope you're among the half of the adult population that is free of them. Given the complexity of life, its diversity in size, shape, and habitat, and our natural disinclination to believe that we are mere products of physical law, it is not surprising that biology lagged behind physics and chemistry in its development as a science. Like those other sciences, for biology to grow, it had to overcome the natural human tendencies to feel that we are special, and that deities and/or magic govern the world. And, as in those other sciences, that meant overcoming the God-centric doctrine of the Catholic Church and the human-centric theories of Aristotle. Aristotle was an enthusiastic biologist. Almost a quarter of his surviving writings pertain to that discipline. And while Aristotle's physics has our Earth at the physical center of the universe, his biology, more personal, exalts humans, and males in particular. Aristotle believed that a divine intelligence designed all living beings, which differ from the inanimate in that they have a special quality or essence that departs or ceases to exist when the living thing dies. Among all those blueprints for life, Aristotle argued, humans represent the high point. On this point, Aristotle was so vehement that when he described a characteristic of a species that differs from the corresponding human characteristic, he referred to it as a deformity. Similarly, he viewed the human female as a deformed or damaged male. The erosion of such traditional but false beliefs set the stage for the birth of modern biology. One of the important early victories over such ideas was the debunking of a principle of Aristotle's biology called spontaneous generation, in which living things were said to arise from inanimate matter such as dust. Around the same time, by showing that even simple life has organs as we do, and that we, like other plants and animals, are made of cells, the new technology of the microscope cast doubt on the old ways of thinking. But biology could not really begin to mature as a science until the discovery of its great organizing principle. Physics, which concerns how objects interact, has its laws of motion. Chemistry, which concerns how elements and their compounds interact, has its periodic table. Biology concerns itself with the ways in which species function and interact, and to succeed, it needed to understand why those species have the characteristics they do, an explanation other than because God made them that way. That understanding finally came with Darwin's theory of evolution based on natural selection. Long before there was biology, there were observers of life. Farmers, fishermen, doctors, and philosophers all learned about the organisms of the sea and the countryside. But biology is more than what is detailed in the catalogs of plants or field guides to the birds. For science doesn't just sit quietly and describe the world, it jumps up and screams ideas that explain what we see. To explain, though, is much more difficult than to describe. As a result, before the development of the scientific method, biology, like the other sciences, was plagued by explanations and ideas that were reasonable but wrong. Consider the frogs of ancient Egypt. Each spring, after the Nile inundated the surrounding lands, it left behind nutrient-rich mud, the kind of land that, through the farmer's diligent toil, would soon feed the nation. The muddy soil also yielded another crop that did not exist on drier land. Frogs. The noisy creatures appeared so suddenly and in numbers so vast that they seemed to have arisen from the mud itself, which is precisely how the ancient Egyptians believed they came into being. The Egyptian theory was not the product of flabby reasoning. Assiduous observers through most of history have reached the same conclusion. Butchers found that maggots appeared on meat. Farmers found mice appearing in bins in which wheat was stored. In the 17th century, a chemist named Jan Baptiste van Helmont even went so far as to recommend a recipe to create mice from everyday materials. Just put a few grains of wheat in the pot, add dirty underwear, and wait 21 days. The recipe reportedly often worked. The theory behind von Helmont's concoction was spontaneous generation, that simple living organisms can arise spontaneously from certain inanimate substrates. Ever since the time of ancient Egypt, and probably before, people believed that some sort of life force or energy exists in all living creatures. Over time, a byproduct of such views was the conviction that life energy could somehow become infused into inanimate matter, creating new life. And when that doctrine was synthesized into a coherent theory by Aristotle, it gained special authority. But just as certain key observations and experiments in the 17th century represented the beginning of the end of Aristotle's physics, so too did the rise of science in that century finally bring his ideas about biology under potent attack. Among the most memorable challenges was a test of spontaneous generation performed by Italian physician Francesco Redi in 1668. It was one of biology's first truly scientific experiments. Redi's method was simple. He procured some wide-mouthed jars and placed in them samples of fresh snake meat, fish, and veal. Then he left some of the jars uncovered, while covering others with a gauze-like material or paper. He hypothesized that if spontaneous generation really occurred, flies and maggots should appear on the meat in all three situations. But if maggots rose instead, as Redi suspected, from tiny invisible eggs laid by flies, they should appear on the meat in the uncovered jars, but not in the jars covered by paper. He also predicted that the maggots would appear on the gauze covering in the remaining jars, which was as close to the meat as the hungry flies could get. That was exactly what occurred. Redi's experiment met with a mixed reception. To some, it appeared to debunk spontaneous generation. Others chose to ignore it or to find fault. Many probably fell in the latter category simply because they were biased toward maintaining their prior beliefs. After all, the issue had theological implications. Some felt that spontaneous generation preserved a role for God in creating life. But there were also scientific reasons for doubting Redi's conclusion. For example, it could be wrong to extrapolate the validity of his experiment beyond the creature he'd studied. Perhaps all he had demonstrated was that spontaneous generation does not apply to flies. To his credit, Redi himself kept an open mind. He even found other cases where he suspected that spontaneous generation did occur. Ultimately, the issue would be argued about for another 200 years. Until Louis Pasteur, in the late 19th century, put it to rest for good with his careful experiments showing that not even microorganisms are generated spontaneously. Still, though not definitive, Redi's work was gorgeous. It stands out especially because anyone could have carried out a similar test, and yet no one thought to. People often think of great scientists as having extraordinary intelligence. And in society, and especially in business, we tend to shun people who don't blend well with others. But it is those who are different who often see what others do not. Reddy was a complex man, a scientist, but also a man of superstition who greased himself with oil to ward off disease, a physician and naturalist, but also a poet who wrote a classic in praise of Tuscan wines. With regard to spontaneous generation, only Reddy was odd enough to think outside the box, and in an age before scientific reasoning was commonplace, he reasoned and acted as scientists do. In doing so, he not only cast doubt on an invalid theory, but he poked a stick at Aristotle and pointed conspicuously to a new approach to answering the questions of biology. Reddy's experiment was in great part a reaction to microscope studies that had recently revealed that minute creatures are complex enough to have reproductive organs. For the belief that lower animals are too simple to reproduce was one of Aristotle's arguments for spontaneous generation. The microscope had actually been invented decades earlier, around the time of the telescope, though no one knows for certain exactly when or by whom. We do know that at first the same Latin word, pers bacillum, was employed for both, and Galileo even used the same instrument, his telescope, to gaze both inward and outward. "With this tube," he told a visitor in 1609, "I have seen flies which look as big as lambs." By revealing the details of a realm of nature that could never have been imagined by the ancients or accounted for in theories, the microscope, like the telescope, eventually helped to open scholars' minds to different ways of thinking about their subject, creating a thread of intellectual progress that would reach a high point with Darwin. But like the telescope, the microscope also initially met with strong opposition. Medieval scholars were wary of optical illusions and distrusted any device that stood between them and the objects they perceived. And while the telescope had its Galileo, who quickly stood up to the critics and adopted the device, it took half a century for the champions of the microscope to make their mark. One of the greatest champions was Robert Hooke, who did his microscopic studies at the behest of the Royal Society and thus contributed to the roots of biology, just as he had contributed to chemistry and physics. In 1663, the Royal Society assigned Hooke the task of presenting at least one novel observation at each meeting. Despite an eye infirmity that made it both difficult and painful to stare into a lens for a long time, he lived up to the challenge and made a long series of extraordinary observations, employing improved instruments that he himself had designed. In 1665, the 30-year-old Hooke published a book titled Micrographia, or Small Drawings. It was a bit of a hodgepodge of Hooke's work and ideas in several fields, but it made a splash by revealing a strange new microworld through 57 amazing illustrations that Hooke himself drew. They exposed to human perception for the first time the anatomy of a flea, the body of a louse, the eye of a fly, and the stinger of a bee, all blown up to full-page images, some even presented as foldouts. That even simple animals have body parts and organs, as we do, was not just a striking revelation to a world that had never seen an insect magnified, it was also a direct contradiction of Aristotelian doctrine, a revelation similar to Galileo's discovery that the moon has hills and valleys, just like the earth does. The year Micrographia was published was the year the Great Plague, which would kill 1 in 7 Londoners, reached its summit. The next year, London was engulfed by the Great Fire. But despite all that chaos and suffering, people read Hooke's book, and it became a bestseller. So engrossed was Samuel Pepys, the famous diarist and naval administrator, and later a member of Parliament, that he sat up until 2 in the morning devouring it, then called it the most ingenious book that ever I read in my whole life. Though Hooke excited a new generation of scholars, he also drew the ridicule of doubters who found it difficult to accept his sometimes grotesque portrayals based on observations employing an instrument they did not trust. The low point came when, attending a satire of contemporary science written by English playwright Thomas Shadwell, Hooke was humiliated upon realizing that the experiments being mocked on the stage before him were mostly his own. They had been drawn from his beloved book. One man who didn't doubt Hooke's claims was an amateur scientist named Anton van Leeuwenhoek. He was born in Delft, Holland. His father made baskets in which the famous blue and white Delft pottery was packaged for shipment around the world. His mother came from a family engaged in another Delft specialty, brewing beer. At age 16, young Anton took a job as a cashier and bookkeeper for a cloth merchant, and in 1654, he opened his own business, selling fabric, ribbons, and buttons. To that, he would soon add another unrelated occupation, seeing to the maintenance and upkeep of Delft's town hall. Leeuwenhoek never attended college and did not know Latin, then the language of science. And though he would live past 90, he left the Netherlands just twice, once to visit Antwerp in Belgium and once to go to England. But Leeuwenhoek did read books, and one that inspired him was Hooke's bestseller. The book changed his life. In its preface, Micrographia explains how to build simple microscopes, and as a fabric merchant, Leeuwenhoek probably had some experience grinding lenses, for he would have needed them to examine samples of linen. But after reading Micrographia, he became a fanatical lens maker, devoting hour after hour to creating new microscopes and making observations employing them. In his early work, Leeuwenhoek simply repeated Hooke's experiments, but he soon eclipsed them. Hooke's microscopes were, for their time, technologically superior, and he had wowed the Royal Society with his magnifications of 20 to 50 power. So one can only imagine the astonishment when, in 1673, the secretary of the society, Henry Oldenburg, received a letter informing him that an uneducated custodian and fabric purveyor in the Netherlands had devised microscopes which far surpass those which we have hitherto seen. In fact, the 41-year-old Leeuwenhoek was reaching magnifications 10 times those achieved by Hooke. It was superior craftsmanship rather than clever design that made Leeuwenhoek's microscopes so powerful. They were in fact simple devices made from just a single lens ground from select fragments of glass or even grains of sand and mounted on plates made from gold and silver that he sometimes extracted from the ore himself. He fixed each specimen permanently and made a new microscope for every study, perhaps because achieving the proper positioning was as difficult as creating the lens. Whatever the reason, he didn't share it with anyone and was generally very secretive about his methods because, like Newton, he wanted to avoid contradiction or censure from others. Over his long life, he produced more than 500 lenses, but to this day, no one knows exactly how he created them. When word of Leeuwenhoek's achievements arrived, the English and Dutch navies were firing cannons at each other in the Anglo-Dutch Wars. But being at war with Leeuwenhoek's country didn't stop Oldenburg. He encouraged Leeuwenhoek to report his findings, and the Dutchman did. In his first letter, Leeuwenhoek, intimidated by the attention of the famous Royal Society, apologized if they noticed shortcomings in his work. It was, he wrote, the outcome of my own unaided impulse and curiosity alone, for beside myself in our town, there are no philosophers who practice this art, so pray, take not amiss my poor pen and the liberty I have taken in setting down my random notions. Leeuwenhoek's notions were an even greater revelation than Hooke's, for where Hooke had seen in detail the body parts of tiny insects, Leeuwenhoek saw entire creatures that were too small to see with the naked eye, complete societies of organisms whose existence no one had previously suspected, some 1,000 or even 10,000 times tinier than the smallest animal visible to the naked eye. He called them animalcules. Today we call them microorganisms. If Galileo reveled in viewing the landscape of the moon and spying the rings of Saturn, Leeuwenhoek took equal delight in observing through his lenses new worlds of bizarre and minute creatures. In one letter, he wrote of the world that existed in a drop of water. "I now saw very plainly that these were little eels or worms, lying all huddled up together and wriggling. The whole water seemed to be alive with these multifarious animalcules. I must say, for my part, that no more pleasant sight had ever come before my eye than these thousands of living creatures, seen all alive in a little drop of water." But if Leeuwenhoek sometimes reported a God's eye overview of entire worlds, in other reports he told of magnifying individual creatures enough to describe many new species in great detail. For example, he described one creature as having stuck out two little horns which were continually moved after the fashion of a horse's ear, with a rounded body, save only that it ran somewhat to a point at the hind end, at which pointed end it had a tail. Over a period of 50 years, Leeuwenhoek never attended a meeting of the Royal Society, but he wrote it hundreds of letters, and the majority have been preserved. Oldenburg had them edited and translated into English or Latin, and the Royal Society published them. Leeuwenhoek's work created a sensation. The world was stunned to learn that there were whole universes of creatures in every drop of pond water, and entire classes of life entirely hidden from our senses. What's more, when Leeuwenhoek turned his microscopes upon human tissue, such as sperm cells and blood capillaries, he helped to reveal our own construction and how it is unexceptional in that we have much in common with other life forms. Like Hooke, Leeuwenhoek had doubters who believed he was making everything up. He countered them by providing signed testimonials from respected eyewitnesses, notaries public, and even the pastor of the congregation in Delft. The majority of scientists believed him, and Hooke was even able to reproduce some of Leeuwenhoek's research. As the word spread, visitors from everywhere showed up at Leeuwenhoek's shop, asking to gaze at his tiny beasts. Charles II, the founder and patron of the Royal Society, asked Hooke for a showing of one of the Leeuwenhoek experiments he had replicated, and Peter the Great of Russia visited Leeuwenhoek himself. Not bad for a guy who ran a fabric store. In 1680, Leeuwenhoek was elected, in absentia, a fellow of the Royal Society, and he kept working till his end, at age 91, some 40 years later. No comparable microbe hunter would come onto the scene for another 150 years. As Leeuwenhoek lay dying, the last thing he did was ask a friend to translate his final two letters into Latin and send them to the society. He also prepared them a gift, a black and gilt cabinet filled with his best microscopes, some of which he had never before shown anyone. Today, only a handful of his microscopes remain intact. In 2009, one sold at auction for £312,000. In his long life, Leeuwenhoek helped establish many aspects of what would become biology: microbiology, embryology, entomology, histology, causing 1/20th century biologists to call Leeuwenhoek's letters the most important series of communications that a scientific society has ever received. Just as important, like Galileo in physics and Lavoisier in chemistry, Leeuwenhoek helped to establish a scientific tradition in the field of biology. As the pastor of the new church at Delft wrote to the Royal Society on Leeuwenhoek's death in 1723, "Anton von Leeuwenhoek considered that what is true in natural philosophy can be most fruitfully investigated by the experimental method, supported by the evidence of the senses. For which reason, by diligence and tireless labor, he made with his own hand certain most excellent lenses, with the aid of which he discovered many secrets of nature, now famous throughout the whole philosophical world. If Hooke and Leeuwenhoek were in a sense the Galileos of biology, its Newton was Charles Darwin. Fittingly, he is buried just a few feet away from Newton in Westminster Abbey, his pallbearers having included two dukes and an earl, as well as past, present, and future presidents of the Royal Society. Though Darwin's burial in an abbey may seem incongruous to some, it would have been unfortunate, said the Bishop of Carlisle in his memorial sermon, if anything had occurred to give weight and currency to the foolish notion that there is a necessary conflict between a knowledge of nature and a belief in God. The interment was a glorious end for a man whose principal scientific achievement was met at first with little more than a yawn, and then with much venom and skepticism. One of those initially underwhelmed was Darwin's own publisher, John Murray, who had agreed to release the book in which Darwin elaborated on his theory, but gave it an initial press run of just 1,250 copies. Murray had good reason to worry, for those who had seen Darwin's book in advance were unenthusiastic. One early reviewer even recommended that Murray not publish it at all. It was an imperfect and comparatively meager exposition of his theory, he wrote. And then the reviewer suggested that Darwin write a book on pigeons instead, and include in that book a brief statement of his theory. Everybody is interested in pigeons, the reviewer advised. The book would soon be on every table. The advice was passed on to Darwin, but he declined it. Not that he himself was confident that his book would sell. God knows what the public will think, he remarked. Darwin need not have worried. On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life, would become biology's Principia. Published on November 24, 1859, all 1,250 copies were immediately snatched up by eager booksellers, and it has been in print ever since. It was gratifying validation for the man who had the passion and patience to spend 20 years accumulating evidence for his ideas, an effort so monumental that just one of its many byproducts was a 684-page monograph on barnacles. Darwin's predecessors had learned many descriptive details about life forms from bacteria to mammals, but they hadn't had a clue about the more fundamental question of what drove species to have the characteristics they possess. Like physicists before Newton, or chemists before the periodic table, pre-Darwinian biologists gathered data, but didn't know how it fit together. They couldn't, for before Darwin, the young field of biology was shackled by the conviction that the origins and interrelationships of different life forms were beyond science, a conviction that arose from the literal acceptance of the biblical story of creation, which held that the earth and all life forms were created in 6 days, and that, in the time since, species had not changed. It's not that there hadn't been thinkers who'd pondered the idea that species evolved. There were, going back to the Greeks, and these included Darwin's own grandfather, Erasmus Darwin. But pre-Darwinian evolution theories were vague and not much more scientific than the religious doctrine they would be replacing. As a result, though there was talk of the idea of evolution before Darwin, most people, including scientists, accepted that humans rested atop a pyramid of more primitive species whose characteristics were fixed and had been designed by a creator to whose thinking we could never be privy. Darwin changed that. If before him there existed a grove of speculations about evolution, his theory towered over the other trees, a majestic specimen of careful science. For every argument or piece of evidence his precursors supplied, he offered 100. More important, he discovered the mechanism behind evolution, natural selection, and thus made evolution theory testable and scientifically respectable, freeing biology from its reliance on God and allowing it to become a true science, one rooted, like physics and chemistry, in physical law. Born at his family's home in Shrewsbury, England, on February 12, 1809, Charles was the son of Robert Darwin, the town physician, and Susanna Wedgwood, whose father had founded the pottery firm of that name. The Darwins were a well-to-do and illustrious family, but Charles was a poor student who hated school. He would later write that he had a bad memory for rote learning and no special talents. He was selling himself short, for he also recognized that he had a great curiosity about facts and their meaning, an energy of mind shown by vigorous and long-continued work on the same subject. These latter two traits are, for a scientist or any innovator, indeed special talents, and they would serve Darwin well. Darwin's curiosity and determination are well illustrated by an incident that occurred when he was in college at Cambridge, obsessed with the hobby of collecting beetles. One day, he wrote, on tearing off some old bark, I saw two rare beetles and seized one in each hand. Then I saw a third and new kind, which I could not bear to lose, so I popped the one which I held in my right hand into my mouth. Only from a boy of that character can emerge a man with the tenacity to put together 684 pages on the topic of barnacles. Though before he was finished, he would write, I hate a barnacle as no man ever did before. It took many years for Charles to find his calling. His journey began in the fall of 1825, when his father sent him, at age 16, not to Cambridge, but to the University of Edinburgh, to study medicine, as both he and Charles's grandfather had done. It proved to be a bad decision. For one, Charles was famously squeamish, and this was an era in which operations featured copious splashes of blood and screaming patients, cut into without the benefit of anesthetic. Still, squeamishness wouldn't stop Charles, years later, from dissecting dogs and ducks as he searched for evidence supporting his theory of evolution. Probably, what proved fatal to his medical studies was the lack of both interest and motivation. As he would later write, he had become convinced that his father would leave him enough property to subsist on with some comfort, and this expectation was sufficient to check any strenuous effort to learn medicine. And so, in the spring of 1827, Charles left Edinburgh without a degree. Cambridge was his second stop. His father sent him there with the idea that he should study divinity and then embark upon a clerical career. This time, Charles completed his degree, ranking 10th out of 178 graduates. His high ranking surprised him, but it reflected, perhaps, that he had developed a genuine interest in geology and natural history, as evidenced by his beetle collecting. Still, he seemed headed for a life in which science would at best be a hobby, while his professional energies would be devoted to the church. But then, on returning home from a post-graduation geological walking tour of North Wales, Darwin found a letter that presented a different option: the chance to sail around the world on the HMS Beagle, under one Captain Robert Fitzroy. The letter was from John Henslow, a Cambridge professor of botany. Despite his high ranking, Darwin hadn't stood out to many at Cambridge. Henslow, however, had seen potential in him. He once remarked, "What a fellow that Darwin is for asking questions." A seemingly bland compliment, but it says that in Henslow's mind, Darwin had the soul of a scientist. Henslow befriended the curious student, and when he was asked to recommend a young man for the position of naturalist on the voyage, he recommended Darwin. Henslow's letter to Darwin was the culmination of a series of unlikely events. It all began when the Beagle's previous captain, Pringle Stokes, shot himself in the head and, after the bullet didn't kill him, died of gangrene. Fitzroy, Stokes' first lieutenant, brought the ship home, but it wasn't lost on him that Stokes' depression had been spurred by the loneliness of a multi-year sea voyage in which the captain was forbidden to socialize with his crew. Fitzroy's own uncle had slit his throat with a razor a few years earlier, and some four decades later, Fitzroy himself would follow suit. so he must have sensed that his captain's fate was one that he should do his best to avoid. As a result, when the 26-year-old Fitzroy was offered the opportunity to succeed Stokes, he decided he needed a companion. It was a custom at the time for the ship's doctor to double as its naturalist. But Fitzroy instead put word out that he sought a young gentleman naturalist of high social standing, a person to serve, essentially, as his hired friend. Darwin was not Fitzroy's first choice for the position, and had previously been offered to a number of others. Had any of them accepted it, Darwin would most likely have proceeded to his quiet life in the church and never created his theory of evolution. Just as Newton would probably never have completed and published his great work had Halley not stopped to see him and asked about the inverse square law. But the position Fitzroy was offering paid nothing. The compensation was to come from the later sale of specimens collected on shore visits along the way. And none of those asked were willing or able to spend years at sea, self-financed. As a result, the choice finally fell to the 22-year-old Darwin, offering him a chance at adventure and to avoid starting a career in which he'd preach that the Earth had been created on the night preceding October 23, 4004 BC, as claimed in a biblical analysis published in the 17th century. Darwin seized the opportunity. It would change both his life and the history of science. The Beagle set off in 1831 and wouldn't return until 1836. It was not a comfortable trip. Darwin resided and worked in the ship's tiny poop cabin in the roughest riding section of the ship. He shared the room with two others and slept in a hammock slung over the chart table. "I have just room to turn round, and that is all," he reported in a letter to Henslow. Not surprisingly, he was racked by seasickness. And though Darwin forged a friendship of sorts with Fitzroy, he was the only member of the ship to have any intimacy with the captain, and they usually dined together, they quarreled often, especially over slavery, which Darwin despised, but which they observed repeatedly.